This audio file comes from the Labrie Ideas Library at www.labrie-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Labrie Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family, and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking prior permission from Labrie Fellowship.
Now, here in this lecture, as I've just said, we're dealing with the subject of introspection. And in my view, this is a disease which is unique to the modern person. And I'm not going to formulate a detailed argument of that point tonight, but I think that introspection is both the fruit of modernism as a set of ideas, and it's also the fruit of modernity as a sociological construct in which we live our lives. So I think we're dealing with something which is unique, and by using the word disease, you should immediately be alert to the fact that I see introspection in a very negative light. Now, I believe that this modern disease affects the life of all of us within the modern context, and my qualification to speak on this subject is simply that I am an introspective person. So I don't speak to you judgmentally in any way, for much of what I'm going to say tonight is going to be rather heavy, but I'm not judging you. I see the seeds of this disease in my own inner world. Now, as we begin to grapple with this subject, one of the problems we have is this. Introspection is so close to us that we can't detect it clearly. I liken it to cancer, which carries out its destruction against our bodies, and until the later stages, we're unaware of its presence. We're oblivious to this absurd fact that the body is turning in against itself. That's what is happening in cancer, with cancer. Well, it's exactly the same with introspection. Yet I believe that with introspection, we have a pathology which is far more horrible than cancer. And I say that knowing a little of how horrible cancer is. But the pathology of introspection is far more horrible. And here we have the inner life of the human turning in against itself, also with devastating consequences. And as this happens, we also are oblivious to its effects. So that's what we're dealing with. Now I want to tackle this subject by asking a few basic questions. My first question is this: what is it? What is introspection? Now, in order to find a way into the maze of the introspective condition, we need to begin with some anthropology. Anthropology is the study of anthros, the study of man, the study of the human person. And what I'm going to say here is very much simplified, because I'm actually looking at the inner life of the human being. And this inner life is extremely complex. So I'm going to make some simplifications as we do this groundwork to understand introspection. Now, the inner life of the human being is called the heart in the Bible. The Bible calls this part of us the heart. And this is the seat, as it were, of our inner existence. Now, in the human heart, there are three functions which connect us in a meaningful way to reality. Three functions. And all of these functions have what I'm going to call tonight an outer directedness. An outer directedness. And these three functions of the human heart are thinking, being, and doing. Thinking, being, and doing. These lie within the human heart and relate us meaningfully to that which is outside of us. Now, at the risk of offending you all, I'm going to do some drawing here. Very simple diagram. Okay, there's the human heart. You recognize heart, okay? Here is reality. We've got thinking here. We've got being. We've got doing. Let me finish that word off. You all see that? Let me put some eyes up here, just to make it a little bit better for you. Is that better? Now, in our relationship to that which is not us, that is, that which is outside of us, that which is other, three things are absolutely critical. First of all, how we think about reality, the thinking process. What we think about reality determines very strongly how we interact with it. So if we think Mount Olympus in Greece is the home for the 12 Olympian gods, that's what we think about it, that is going to determine our real involvement with that mountain. Similarly, if the mountain is just a massive hunk of rock, that is also going to determine how we interact with it. For the modern, it'll simply be a big rock to be conquered, to be climbed. Now, thinking takes place through the rational process, through rationality. And I believe rationality is found in the human heart. And this is the epistemological component of our engagement with the real. If I lose anyone along the way here, just for a few moments, don't worry too much. So first of all, it's critical how we think about reality. Secondly, it's critical how we experience it. So here we have thinking, rationality. Secondly, it's critical how we experience it. As human beings, we have this ability to participate in reality. Here's another key word for tonight. The ability to participate in reality. To participate is to have a first-hand experience of life. To touch what's outside of you deeply. It's all about being there, really being there, and actualizing what's there for you in the present. And it is critical in terms of the operation of the heart, how we experience reality. Now I'm going to make another very critical point here. We can only have a solid sense of ourself if we have a first-hand participation in reality. We need a real experience of reality if we're going to have a solid self of who we are. Now tonight I'm only going to state that as a fact. I have a few other lectures where I try to develop this thought, but tonight I'm just going to state it as a fact. It's only as you move from self to a participation in reality that you have being. That's my point. And this participation takes place through what I have termed imagination. And like rationality is found in the heart, so is imagination. And again, I've devoted several lectures to this subject. If anyone's interested, you can look up in our tape catalog, Symbols, Imagination, and Spiritual Reality. I can't give any more time to this particular point tonight. Simply to reemphasize that it's through the use of our imagination and through symbols, which are God's gift to us, that we gain the power to be. And that comes from a deep participation and experience of reality. We call this the ontological component. Thirdly, in our relationship to reality, it is also critical how we behave towards it. Reality calls us to certain responses. That's the doing part. And these responses are prompted by the will. So will, imagination, rationality reside in the human heart. Now we're talking about will. It's the will that moves us to certain choices. Now, reality is governed by law, a law which is outside of the self. And our will is meant to be responsive to that law. Now, however we think law is defined, whether it's defined by nature, if you're a materialist, whether it's defined by the gods, or whether it's defined by Yahweh, the God of Abraham. Reality is governed by law, and our wills are meant to be a response to this law here. From here to here, a response to law. And we call this morality. And now within 5 minutes, we've touched on the three main branches of philosophy. Epistemology, which is to do with our thinking. Ontology, which is to do with our being. Morality, which is to do with our doing. And it's interesting, if you look at the Bible, you will see that the Bible addresses all three of these functions of the heart, our thinking, our being, and our doing. because each of these is necessary to a proper engagement with reality. For example, I can't go into this in detail, if you turned later to Matthew 13, where you have the parable of the sower, you would see there firstly that Jesus addresses our rationality. He addresses our thinking. He wants to bring us to the place of understanding. That's what this parable is about. He wants us to have right thinking. But then you notice, secondly, that he addresses our imagination. He talks in a parable. It's a symbol for our imagination to take hold of, because he wants to connect us to the reality of what he's talking about. He's concerned with being there. Then notice that finally that he also addresses our will. This parable is all about acting on the word. The farmer sows the seed and you're to act. That's the word, and you're to act on it. So the emphasis is all upon doing. There in one parable you see that all three of these functions of the heart are addressed. Now these three functions of the heart, work very, very differently. If you like, they're separate spheres of operation. However, they are all meant to be totally integrated in the task of truthfully and meaningfully connecting us to the real. So different and yet integrated in the way they work. And as I said earlier, all have this character of outer directedness. They go beyond the self. They start from the heart within the self and they move beyond it. They're outwardly directed. So we are to think about that which is other than us. And we're to act or to do in obedience to that which is other than us. Other here being defined by law. Now when these two things are happening, we're thinking about that which is other than us, we're acting upon that which is other than us, which is the law. When that's happening, our imagination enables us to participate in reality firsthand. We have the experience then of being. My point being this, that the outer directedness of thinking and doing is key to being. You need both of those to go outward if you're going to have being, true sense of being. Now that's covered a lot of ground very, very quickly. Now we go back to where we began. What is introspection? Well, introspection is what happens when rationality and will no longer have outer directedness. That's introspection. When it actually goes the other way. When these two things turn inwards, we become locked into the self. And when that happens, these two things go the wrong direction, it crushes our ability to be. It crushes our ability to participate fully in reality. And what happens is that our rationality, our thinking, and our will, the doing, actually turn in on the imaginative faculty. And they begin to destroy it. That's what happens in introspection. So when our thinking and our doing no longer become bigger than the self because of this inward turn, we become introspective. We no longer respond to a reality outside of the self. And at this point, our existence becomes a transaction of thinking over being and a transaction of doing over being, because this becomes destroyed. So thinking over being and doing over being. Now in order to understand what introspection is, I want to focus on these two movements. First of all, thinking over being. What happens here? Well, last century, Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, lamented this, that modern man had forgotten how to exist, forgotten how to participate in reality. And he said, we can only think and talk about being. That's all we can do, he said. Now that describes the introspective condition. What we do here is we substitute for reality merely our ideas about reality. So the focus now is on what we think. That's the focus. And the movement is inward rather than outward, focusing on what we think. Now, I need to use an illustration here which is crude and offensive. But the problem is, it is so accurate. And I cannot pass it by. It is so accurate, we need to understand this condition.
You're all waiting now, aren't you?
Introspection is mental masturbation. That's what it is. Mental masturbation. Now, when God created human sexuality, He always intended that we experience our sexuality with another person. That is, it had this outer directedness. Now, when you masturbate, you have no participation with anything outside of yourself. It's an inwardly directed practice. And there's no connection with the real world. And I don't say this to raise a laugh. Your partner may be gorgeous, but he or she just doesn't exist. They're not real. You're in a world of fantasy. It's all about non-participation. Now, that's exactly what introspection is. It's mental masturbation, where our thinking takes place apart from any real participation in reality. You see, God intended that our thinking and our being take place at the same time, in the same direction. And it was to be outer-focused, dealing with reality. Remember I said when thinking turns inward, it crushes out the power to be. And that means we no longer touch the real in terms of our participation. And we end up with a mental masturbation. Now this type of thinking, introspective thinking, soon becomes hyper-rational. And that's because of this loss of being. So we become hyper-rational, and we compulsively over-intellectualize everything. That's introspection. Compulsively over-intellectualizing everything. And we do this because of the pain of the loss of being. Remember, we can only have being when we participate in reality. But this has been scrubbed out. And the loss of that is painful. So now we over-intellectualize everything. And the more we lose the power to be, the more compulsive our hyper-analysis becomes. So it's thinking, 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 thinking. And it's like a tumble dryer which turns and turns and turns and never stops. Now this increasingly destroys our capacity for being when we do this. And you see a terrible cycle of tragedy here. The more hyper-analytical we become, the less being we have, because its thinking is going in the wrong direction. And this leads to even more intense hyper-analysis. I remember a few years ago at La Brie, we had two very introspective students, one a male and one a female, and they became, as sometimes happened, a courting couple. Now I happened to be tutoring one, and I know this for a fact, that this couple spent hundreds of hours analyzing their relationship. Hundreds. They didn't study, they just talked about their relationship. And they never experienced it once. That's what I'm talking about. Over-intellectualization. Compulsive. And they actually destroyed the power to be within that relational framework. So think of something as beautiful as a relationship, and they were never there. They had no participation. And they seriously damaged each other. Serious damage. When we introspect, we practice the presence of self. That's what we're doing. It's the practice of the presence of self. And the only thing we can do within the self is to think, is to hyperanalyze. And without this capacity to be, The only way we can experience ourselves is in thinking, and it's thinking cut off from being. That's how we experience ourselves. So this means we think reality apart from any first-hand experience of it. That's what Kierkegaard was saying. When are we going to start existing, participating in reality, rather than just thinking and talking about it? So that's the first thing, thinking over being. That's the one side of the equation. The other is doing over being. Doing over being. So here's the mode of existence where we do, and again, it's at the expense of being. Another word for this is activism. It's the curse of the modern age, activism. Ceaseless doing with little first-hand experience. Now, at first glance, activism looks very unlike our symbolic picture of introspection. I think for years, my symbolic picture of introspection was that famous piece of Greek sculpture, the thinker, like this. Very still, thinking really hard. Now we need to begin by appreciating this fact. The activist is so busy doing that he or she becomes separated from being. Now it may look like they're being. High energy person, full of life, want a party every time. They're all doing. It looks so impressive. The car they drive, the places they travel to. But this is all pseudo-being. Because when doing is over-being, you have no first-hand experience of life. But this reminds me of traveling today. I don't want to hurt anyone here. I think traveling is the most overrated thing in the world. People rushing and scurrying about Europe. And my question is, were they ever there? Were they really there, firsthand? I remember 2 years ago, we had our members meeting in Holland. And Ranald McCauley went a few days early and went to the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. All these, the best collection of the Dutch masters you can imagine. And Ranald said there was a woman beside him who was also going around this museum, and she had one of these video cameras. And it's the one, a big one that you look down in. And she was standing in front of these Rembrandts looking down, and she'd nudge Ranald and say, "Look." And Ranald said, "It was there. But she wanted me to look into the camera." He said they went around the whole museum with this woman looking at the pictures through the camera. You know, that woman couldn't experience the gallery properly until she went home, relaxed, and plugged her video camera into the TV. Now that, folks, is what you call a second-hand experience. She wasn't there. It was all about doing over being. Now we live today in a very frenetic world. There is so much busyness and so much hurry, and it affects all of us. And in all that hurry and all that busyness, there's just no time to be. In fact, our busyness actually annihilates the power to be because it's doing over being. Now, this loss of being and the busyness is very painful, extremely painful, because we don't feel very real in that. The loss of being is to feel unreal. And the way we avoid the pain of not being is to become even more activist. To fill up all the empty spaces, doing over being at an even more extreme pitch. Now, of course, in this kind of lifestyle, all of our doing, all of our activities serve no higher goal than the self. It's all about serving the interest of self. So the exercise of our will is no longer outer directed in its focus. And because there's this lack of participation in reality, there's no higher law to which the will gives its obedience in terms of its choices. The law is no bigger than the self. This is what this is supposed to be doing. Points this way, and we're responding to law outside of ourselves. But now there is no law here because it's going back the other way. And this again leads the focus back inward again. And it's back to the masturbation thing. One more time. It's the loss of the power to be. There's no participation in other. And we're back to the practice of the presence of self. Lost in ceaseless doing. And in this type of mode, again, we can only think about life. Rather than experiencing it, participating in it. And I think it can be argued that doing over being leads back to actually thinking over being. All you can do is really think life. But whatever is happening, introspection is the end result. But there's a very brief look at what introspection is. And we're looking really here at its inner dynamics, its engine. What makes it go, what makes it move. There's one more thing here that I want to say about introspection under this heading. We need to see that introspection functions as an idolatry in our existence. It functions as an idolatry. Now, I believe before the modern period, idolatry always had an outward focus. You take the God of Israel. The God of Israel was beyond and is beyond representation. That's what it means to say that God is holy. He's other. You cannot represent him. There's nothing in creation which will truthfully represent him. And yet in the pre-modern period, we see the Israelites doing it many times, God was falsely represented within nature. And there was nothing beyond to which nature pointed. That's how we're meant to handle nature according to the Bible. It simply points to the glory of God. But pre-modern idolatry made nature the thing in and of itself. There was nothing beyond it. And the pre-modern person participated in nature as though it were God. Nature became the God substitute. That was the focus of the idolatry then. I believe the focus of idolatry in the modern period is uniquely inward. And I'm still working on this at the moment in some of my reading. It's a fascinating thesis, which is traced out in particular by Owen Barfield. The focus of idolatry in the modern period is uniquely inward. And it's inward in this sense, that the idol today is the self. I think Paul was perhaps pointing to this in 2 Timothy 3 verse 2 when he talked about the last days. Now, at one level you can say, it's correct to say that Paul was referring to any time after the ascent of Christ. But I think there's also an aspect in this phrase, the last days, where he's really throwing ahead his perspective. And he said, in the last day, men and women are going to become lovers of themselves. Meaning, I think, that there's going to be no participation beyond the self. The real will no longer exist in terms of being. There'll be no more first-hand experiences, no more real participation. The self will be as far as it goes because of introspection. And I believe this is where the forces of modernity and modernism have led us, to the idolatry of introspection. And again, I've done a lecture or two which traces the history of that. So it's not part of my intention, as I said, to show this process. I just want to say that in my view, introspection is a uniquely modern phenomena, and it functions as a modern idolatry. Let me move on now to my second point. What does introspection do to us? What does it do to us? Well, there are four things I want to mention here, and I'm only going to touch on them very, very briefly. But I think hope each of these will give us a greater understanding of what introspection is. The first thing introspection does to us is this, that it empties us. It empties us. I have stated tonight, without trying to demonstrate how or why, that we only enter the state of being through a participation in the real. The self has to go beyond itself in order to find an identity. It's another way of saying this point. Now that means that the more we're cut off from our participation in reality, the less real we are. If we need to do that in all three directions in order to find a sense of being, if we go the other way and this is cut out, we're going to become less real. And I tried to show you that introspection and its inner workings is a flight from participation. Now that is why it's a condition which gradually carves us out and empties us as human beings. You remember Bilbo Baggins? 60 years with a ring. What did it make him feel like? It made him feel thin. Remember what he said to Gandalf? I feel so thin, Gandalf, like butter, little butter spread over a big piece of bread. Wonderful picture. Now that's exactly what introspection does to us, because it takes away this power to be. Introspection leads to emptiness and thinness. And that's what intense introspection feels like. If you are an intensely introspective person, you feel empty. Now, the greater the emptiness you feel, the greater the darkness which you experience. And I say that for the following reason. In the Bible, light is always associated with weight. The word glory means weighty, it means substantial. That which is full of light is full of heaviness, in the best sense of the word. It's substantial, it's real. Darkness, on the other hand, is always associated with emptiness, with nothingness. But this is why, for the introspective person, darkness is always the most real thing. Introspection carves you out, makes you thin, makes you empty. That emptiness is felt as darkness. I've been asking myself for years, why do modern people embrace darkness? Why do they love darkness so much? I think it's because it's the one thing we can relate to. We can't relate to the light because we're so empty. The light is so full. You see, emptiness and darkness are synonymous with one another. And for the introspective person, they're both real, or can I put it, unreal. But they're there. But this idea of introspection is something which empties us is a horrible, horrible thought. And I see introspection as a horrible, horrible thing. In fact, these days I see introspection as the perfect metaphor for hell. And I'm one of those strange people who believes in hell. I see it as a metaphor of hell, and it terrifies me far more than the flame metaphors do. The idea of a person who's lost forever within themselves, forever growing thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. And as they grow thinner, they have this ever-increasing experience of emptiness and darkness that never, never, never ends. I think hell is going to be very close to that kind of experience. And that's why introspection is so horrible, this modern disease that plagues us today. Secondly, what does it do to us? It makes us lonely. It makes us lonely. Loneliness is a direct consequence of introspection. Introspection deprives us of the power to be. And we become locked into this unreal world of our own mental thoughts, no longer engaged with the real. Now, within that world, we no longer have the ability to form true bonds of intimacy. It's just not possible. Because intimacy requires a real participation with the other. Now, there are, of course, for the introspective person, plenty of false intimacies that we can embrace. And because introspective people feel very empty, we easily fall into false intimacies. A false intimacy is actually where we fall into another person and try to suck the life out of them in order to make us try and feel more real. So we may be able to have some false intimacies, but it's all self-referential. But all the while, true intimacy will elude us, and we will remain the lonely subject. This is what Kierkegaard talked about so much. 19th century men and women is the lonely subject. Restless, driven along by the loss of our being, and never able to really stop and just be in the presence of other. Introspection makes us lonely. What does introspection do to us? Thirdly, it gives us an inability to live in the present. An inability to live in the present. You know, the only place in time that you can truly be is in the present moment. That's the only place where you exist concretely. You can't have a first-hand experience of either the past or the future. You're never there. I mean, really there. The past and the future only exist in your thoughts. Now, to be is to actualize the present moment. It's to participate in it. It's to dance with it. But because introspection has lost the power of being, you cannot actualize the present. And that means you live only in the world of thought. And living in the world of thought, you're constantly straying either towards the past or towards the future. Because the past and the future exist only in thought. And that's the only place where you exist. That's why you're constantly going back between those two things. You can't actually live in the present and actualize it. And this inability to actualize the present further takes away the possibility of being. It's a vicious cycle. Going through these quickly, the fourth one. What does it do to us? It gives us an inability to live with wonder. An inability to live with wonder. You know, when we have this power to be, this power to participate, the heart is alive and all these functions are pointing outward. When we have that, we are constantly touching a world which is bigger than our capacity for intellection. Constantly. You see, to participate in the real is to engage in something which inspires poetic awe. Now, I'm not saying here that the intellect plays no part in understanding the real. It plays a very key part. However, reality can never be contained by our intellectual concepts. Now, outside of the introspective condition, that doesn't matter. And that's why the person who's not introspective is quite able to deal with mystery. And it's the mystery of the world around us that inspires the wonder. You can't have wonder without mystery. If you've got it all boxed up in a concept, you'll never have wonder. The person who's not introspective, who's living in this world, full of wonder because this is full of mystery. And it's the wonder that keeps us participating. It keeps pulling us out more and more and more. The power to be comes from the wonder. Now, on the other hand, for the introspective person who could only think reality, mystery and wonder have no legitimacy. And that's why everything is subjected to analysis. Everything has to fit very neatly into the world of thought. And if it doesn't, it has no legitimacy. Now, when I meet a Labrie student, or anyone for that matter, who cannot cope with mystery, the person for whom every question has to be boxed up, nice and tidily, and if it's not, you've got to keep pushing till you get there, that for me is almost always a sure sign of introspection. Poets who participate in reality never have a problem with mystery. We've lost a sense of wonder and mystery. It's because we become lost within this world, the introspective world. So that's briefly what it does to us. The next question is this: how do we get out? This must be the most depressing lecture you've ever heard. Talk about bad news. And the question now is this: is there any good news? Come on, man, show us the light. That's what I hope you're saying. Well, I want to close here by outlining a way out of this hellish condition of introspection. And this way has three strands to it. One way with three strands. And all of these strands are very interconnected. in some respects saying the same thing, but I'm just coming at it from a number of different angles. First of all, how do we escape introspection? We need to hear the call to love. We need to hear the call to love. You know, introspection is the opposite of love. And that's because ultimately everything is focused within the self. It's so self-referential. But by way of contrast, love has this outer directness that we've been talking about tonight. That's love. Or it's the beginning of love. And you know, the call to love, which comes to each of you tonight, is a call to get out of your head. That's what it's a call to do, to get out of your head and to stop intellectualizing everything. The call to love is a call to participation. It's a call to a love affair with all that is other and real. That's what we're called to. And that means opening our ears, participating in bird song. You heard the birds singing today? The love affair with other and real means opening our eyes, participating in the turning of the seasons. Changing a bit more every day, aren't they, those leaves? That's what it's about. It's a call to love and to delight in the world around you. It's a call to stand in the present and to actualize the moment. And in doing that, you will begin to be, because that's the only place you exist, concretely, in the present. The call to love means delighting in mystery and not running away from those things which are beyond your intellection. So it's goodbye to thinking over being. The call to love is a call to poetry, a call to wonder, a call to song and dance. That's what it is. And then above all, the call to love is a call to God. That's what the call to love is. It's a call to God. The God who is love. Because you know, the God who calls us to himself is the only one who is weighty enough to draw us up and out of ourselves. This problem of introspection is so great. We need someone very, very real and substantial to pull us out. This God is substantial enough, more than substantial. He is the all-glorious one. And a call to him is a call to come up and out of ourselves, to the deepest participation possible in reality. Now, if you're introspective, you need saving. It's a type of hell, and you need saving. And you know, Yahweh can do this. He's the only one who can do this. He can save you from this hell you're in. Only he's weighty enough. I could read 100 Bible passages now, but listen to a little bit of Psalm 34. Taste and see that the Lord is good. That's participation, isn't it? Not, so what do you think about God today? Now that's important, but it's not enough. Taste and see that the Lord is good. God is more than a thought. You could take Kierkegaard's statement, his quote, and say, we've got to stop just thinking about God, and talking about God, and start participating in the reality of God. The psalm goes on, whoever of you loves life and desires to see many good days, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking lies. Turn from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Whoever of you loves life, there's the call to love. Do you love life? We all want to love life. And I hear the psalmist saying, stop your talking. All this deceit, the web of deceit you're caught in, stop all of that. Your lips, you keep talking about reality. No participation. If you love life, turn away from all of that and just do good. Seek peace and pursue it. That's the call to love. Secondly, how do we get out? We have the call to solitude. The call to solitude. Now, this call to solitude is a check on the activism that I talked about earlier. Activism is about doing over being. We've got to hear the words of that wonderful Simon and Garfunkel song. Slow down, you move too fast. Gotta make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy. You know, it's only in solitude, when we slow down, find the place of quiet, it's only then that we can listen with attention to other. We'll never get in touch with that unless we slow down and be quiet, find the place of solitude. I believe the power to be starts in solitude, in the place of quiet. Now, in the place of quiet and solitude, the first thing we do is we listen to self. You can't help but do that when you're quiet. Listen to self. You say, that's introspection. But you know, the listening in solitude is not introspection. Because if it's a true listening, the listening of the Bible, the listening that God calls us to, it's a listening in the presence of another. It's not, I hate to use this term, but it works. It's not mental masturbation. It's listening in the presence of another. Listen to this well-known verse, 2 Corinthians 13. Examine yourselves. Ooh, that sounds introspective. Examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not realize that Christ Jesus is in you? Unless, of course, you fail the test. Listen to yourself. Why? So you can discover the presence of another there. The presence of Jesus Christ. You find the place of solitude, Paul's saying, and you examine yourself there, and you'll discover the greatest truth about you. The truth that you are not alone. God is in you. God is in you. You are His dwelling place. What a truth. And to participate in that in the place of solitude, to hear, to touch firsthand the reality of His indwelling, is to touch the very ground of reality. Self-examination is not about the practice of the presence of self. That's introspection. Self-examination is the practice of the presence of the living God. That's what it's about. And that's what it means to be a Christian, to be indwelt by the living God. And we practice His presence. We're not alone. When we reach the place of solitude. And you know, because He's really there, as we participate in His presence, that presence will radiate up and through us. And I believe this will shape our thinking. That's what happens with the real presence right there. The real presence of God. Shape our thinking. So it goes this way. Shape our doing. So we have holy thinking, holy rationality, holy intellect, holy imagination leading to being, and holy will. That's what His presence within is doing. Transforming us, changing us. So I'm saying only in the place of solitude can you participate in the real presence of God. It's not just an idea. It's real. And that's why we have to say goodbye to activism today. If you guys are doing too much, give it up. Say no. We have to say goodbye to doing over being, because that leads to introspection. You know the words of Psalm 46, verse 10, "Be still and know that I am God." It's actually an imperative. You must be still. You must be still. If you're going to know, same word for sexual intercourse, not just intellection, thought, no. If you're going to know, participate, that's what that's about. If you're going to know that I am God, if you're going to participate in me, you have to be still. And earlier in that psalm, participation is given as a picture of this river flowing through us. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, where the Most High dwells. God is within her. Now we know in the light of the new covenant that this city is you and I. We're believers. We are that city. And I believe it's only a participation in His indwelling presence that can set us free from introspection. And that's why we have to hear the call to solitude. So we can touch firsthand the real presence of the indwelling God. Then finally, how do we get out? We have to hear the call to obedience. The call to obedience. Now this idea of obedience is so oppressive to us today. It seems like obedience acts against the interests of the self. But you know, for the introspective person, it really is the way out. It's the way out. Listen to Jesus in John 15. John 15, verse 9. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. Not as an idea. Remain in the reality of my love. Participate in it. If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love. Just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. What is this saying? It's saying that obedience to the law of Christ draws us into a participation with the best of reality, the most real of reality, God himself. Obedience leads to a real participation in the love of God. Now the dynamics of this transaction are critical for us to grasp. First of all, we're called to be obedient to a law which transcends the self. Not a law just as big as the self, but it goes, it's outer, directed, and it's focused, it's bigger than the self. And as the will responds to this call, we are drawn out of the self to a participation in God. And you know, that's why the law is such a blessing. If we could only grasp this, if I could grasp it today. The law actually gives our will, that which moves us to respond, it gives the will something to respond to with outer directedness. Not, oh, what should I obey today in terms of my little feelings and wants, sense of what my rights are. What is law outside of me? And my will responds to that as it goes outward. And Jesus is saying, in obedience to that law, we are drawn up into the life of God himself. Now for us introspectives, it's as simple as this. We just need to hear what God calls us to through his commandments. And that's something beyond our introspective thinking. And then we just have to do it. It's as simple as that. If we started being obedient to the commands and laws of God, it would change our lives. I promise you. Change our lives. Because here I'm simply telling it like Jesus did in John 15. Obey my commands and then you'll experience my love. You'll participate in something outside of yourself. And that's going to set you free from introspection. Just simple obedience. It's such a powerful thing. I believe if we could recover the call to obedience, we could transform our lives. That's what I'm saying. It's as simple as that. The call to love, the call to solitude, and the call to obedience. I want to close this evening by sharing a prayer with you. This prayer comes in the form of a collect from the Book of Common Prayer. And this is a prayer for the introspective person. And I believe if we prayed this every day, we would be changed. Now, if you want a copy of this prayer, ask me, ask Dawn, ask Michelle, because we prayed it together this morning. Listen to this. Almighty and eternal God, so draw our hearts to you. There it goes, outer directedness. So draw our hearts to you. So guide our minds. So fill our imagination. So control our wills, that we may be wholly yours. Utterly dedicated to you. To you, and then use us as you want, and always to your glory and the welfare of your people, through our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Amen. Let me pray this one more time. Almighty and eternal God, so draw our hearts to you, so guide our minds, so fill our imaginations, so control our wills, that we may be wholly yours, utterly dedicated to you. And then use us as you want us, and always to your glory, and to the welfare of your people, through our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Amen. That's all I'm going to say tonight by way of lecture. Do you have questions you want to bring to the whole issue of introspection? Comments? Lots of things left untouched there. And I try to reflect that side of it when I talked about it as an idolatry. And anything that is an idol, we are responsible for. We have made the self to be an idol, and that is a sin. I agree with you. I also want to state, on the other hand, it doesn't free us from the responsibility, but we are victims of some massive, massive lies that modernity, as a sociological construct, and modernism have foisted on us. And I want to hold everything you say. We are responsible. That's where I'm coming at the end. If it was just, like you say, a disease, where's the pill? This is a call to do something. But at the same time, I want to acknowledge that we live as children of the Enlightenment, and we live with the devastating consequences of that. Devastating. And it's the ultimate irony of our lives, isn't it? We've never had it so good. Look at our lives, all of us. I don't want to speak for all of us, but we have it pretty good materially, in terms of our freedoms and so forth, and yet, have we ever been more empty and miserable because of this introspective condition? So, and I don't want to say victim as in, we just have to sit back and be swept out by it, but we need to understand where this is coming from, which I haven't dealt with tonight, in terms of the roots of where this has come from. But I think that's an excellent point. I think a materialistic worldview is definitely a cause of it. It's one of the reasons why we've retreated into the self. And at the end of the day, participation, this gets into a whole other area, but participation is only possible in something which is personal. You can't participate in a machine, and that this world is only a machine, which is what scientism posits. There's no possibility for participation, which is why I think we're in a unique period historically. Many things historically just repeat themselves over and over and over, but in this respect, I think we have a change. Because as I said, idolatry, old style, was always a participation in nature, but nature was personal. It was full of gods. It was people with many different gods. The god of the sun, god of the... And they all had names. Scientism says there's nothing personal there to participate in at all. So that actually drives us inward. So there I'm saying it's a cause. Yes, interesting thing. At my table the other day, someone raised the, is an introvert more prone to introspection than an extrovert? And those categories don't quite work for me, but that's probably my problem. Is a depressive person more prone to introspection? Or is it the other way around? I certainly think that introspection is a cause of a lot of depression. The emptiness is just overwhelming. I think it's very important to say what you have there. There are types of depression which I think are unrelated to this completely. But the wide-scale nature of depression today is just unprecedented, isn't it? You see something in the papers almost every day about, you know, the cause for concern here. And I think that the general type of depression we see is related to this. I want to be a bit careful, because this can just be a construct through which you jam everything. But I would tend in that direction. It's a philosophical term, which I don't know if it means anything to many, but the whole idea of this participation, this real participation, is what we're all made for. And many of us have given up the hope that that's even possible. We're just so lost in it. But my thirst for that is so deep, especially participating in God. I think as Christians, we become quickly disillusioned if God is only a thought. We can only think Him rather than participate in Him. And yet, because He dwells within us, our deepest longing is to know Him in that way. As I say, the word know for sexual intercourse, the same one, is the deepest type of intimacy, the real first-hand thing. That's where, and I didn't go into it in any detail at all, but I'd want to make a distinction between introspection and self-examination. And the Bible actually commands us, it's an imperative, to examine ourselves.
which means that we need to listen to what's happening in our inner worlds, because it's only from there that we can possibly put things right. But as I said, that listening is never just with ourselves. It really is in the presence of another. And also, self-examination for me is so different from introspection, because it takes what is true outside of us so seriously. So for instance, self-examination can be, how am I doing as a Christian? Is this just a joke? Is this just a hobby that I'm doing, which has no reality? How do I figure that out? Well, the Bible would say, I've been brought to Christ in order to be made like Him. So what's Christ like? That's a question which is outside of my own introspective processes. What is Christ like? I can measure myself against that. So it's not subject on subject. It has this idea of other in it. So I think it's very, very important. And sometimes we have to listen actually to the introspection going on and say, that is just so bad. That is stopping me from hearing the birds sing. And I think our inner voices can tell us all sorts of things. It can tell us about how twisted our desires are. Desires which should bring us to God are being diverted in other directions. So the last thing I'm talking about is that I'm going to block off completely from myself. It's the way we engage in our self-introspection which I'm moving against. Modernity has constructed a world which is so cut off from reality in some ways. We live in, to use Baudrillard's term, in a hyper-reality. And if you're living in a hyper-reality, hyper-analysis is going to go right alongside of that. So in terms of a cultural analysis, there's so much which could be done with this still, this material, but I'd love to think more or hear more. I don't have any expertise there, but where it manifests itself in education. Because that's critical. For me, the value of a good biblical therapeutic approach is to point people beyond the self to what can truly ground them as individuals. And so if we're only leaving people there, we're not doing them any favors at all. You're relating it to the doing over being. You're saying in that doing, obedience, but actually there's no participation in life. I think often that kind of obedience is a self-constructed obedience or a socially constructed obedience, as in this is what the church says in this moment in time that obedience to Christ is, and not those more temporary relative mores, if I can call them that, are always wrong. I think we can't exist without them. Often they become so weighed down and dead and meaningless that if we're just caught up in that, the reality of God is gone. And I actually think part of the Holy Spirit's ongoing revelation to us is what obedience really means to His commands in the big sense. The biggest call to obedience being the call to love. This is why I said all of these are interconnected. But I think for us in our age of activism to be as hard on those in the past who have sought solitude as we are on them, I think is a little bit thin. I think actually today is a day we can begin learning from the example of those who actually practice the presence of God in solitude. Now, there are certain forms of monasticism which I just think are dreadfully unhelpful, and they were just a complete withdrawal from the reality of this world anyway. I think when you read the writings, it'd be hard to say that it was just introspection. I think it was more God at the expense of anything else. Yeah, I mean, there's lots I'd love to say to all of that. Well, it's interesting, you mentioned now, and now in his book, Reaching Out, someone put that into my hands just yesterday, because they said, you've got to figure out the place of solitude in this whole thing, discussing it with them. And in a chapter there, he quotes from Thomas Merton, and how Thomas Merton came to the deepest participation in man, as it were, by being a hermit. And there's a whole chapter there about how compassion for the world is often comes from somewhat withdrawing from it, not turning your back on it, but you can actually participate more fully in it when you're not just caught up in all the activism. But I don't want to stand up here and defend the hermitage and hermit existence, and certainly not mysticism. I think mysticism is very dangerous in that area, very dangerous. But I maybe it's just because I want to maintain my argument that it's modern. I'd want to say something a little different from introspection. I don't want to oversimplify things which are very complex at one level. But you know, to shape our consciousness around this reality, that God is in us, that marked our consciousness as we entered the place of solitude. He is in me. Now, I mean, He is really in me. That will change the nature of that, you know, that act, that of being in the place of solitude. And I'm with C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis said that's the one truth that we're constantly falling away from, that God is in us. When was the last time you thought it? Those of you who are Christians. I am indwelt by the living God. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit really live in me. We'll fall away from it pretty quickly, don't we? And just that thought in the place of solitude, you're dealing with something which is... And this is where thinking is part of it. It's saying, you start with the thought outside, although it's inside, but it's outside, it's beyond, it's not myself. God is in me. And then I'm going to act on the basis of that. So both of these going that direction, only that will give me the possibility for being, which is why I think those three arrows, this has to be in place and this has to be in place before this can be in place. When those two reverse, you can't have being. Philippians 4:8. Now, it starts with the thinking again. But this is where you start in solitude. That's a great point. Philippians 4:8. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, take this as a commandment. We're obedient to this. Whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Now I want to say here tenderly, some people are so locked into introspection they don't know where to begin that process. They can't put their mind on something which is true, pure, lovely, admirable. That's where I think the power of imagination comes in. You have to actually begin to symbolize these things in order to sort of get them before the horizon of your consciousness. But I think in the place of solitude, we can't help but listen to what's going on within. And that's always going to be painful, which is the point you just raised. That's always going to be painful. And we have to learn how to stay there. Actually, we have to learn first how to get there. Where do we get any possibility for solitude in the modern world? Where is there any encouragement to them? With the camper van, there you go. Buy a VW camper van and enter the life of the hermitage. for me, it's pure boredom, and I need to try and turn boredom into solitude. Yeah, I wonder how you do that. That's interesting. I'll pray about that. Good. Well, let's leave it there. Thank you for your attention and your comments, and I'll reflect on it some more. Thank you.